It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Tax season is underway in Wisconsin and around the country. That means millions of people will be filling out their tax returns for the state and federal governments over the next few months.
And this year marks the first year that many Wisconsin filers are eligible for the IRS free direct file online system.
What do Wisconsin taxpayers need to know this year? David Casey is Secretary Designee of the State Department of Revenue. Secretary Casey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey there. My pleasure.
What changes, if any, should filers be aware of this tax season?
Well, we've got a few exciting changes this year. First of all, we have the Child and Dependent Care Credit expansion. So last spring, Governor Evers signed into law legislation that expands the state's Child and Dependent Care Tax Credit from 50% to 100% of the federal credit. This is going to help, you know, families grappling with child care expenses significantly. Just for a reference point, it can provide a credit that ranges between $2,000 and $3,500 for a family with one dependent and $4,000 to $7,000 credit for two or more dependents. So a big change there that should help help families this year.
What do people who are eligible for that need to do to make sure they get that credit, especially if it's something different than they've seen in past year's filings?
Actually, not a whole lot. What they'll see on their return, they'll just be able to get the credit changed from 50% to 100%. So if they're used to filling out that credit on their tax form, do the same thing this year, and they'll get the 100% rather than the 50%. We do have a couple other just changes that I think are going to be big and positive as well. And one of those is the organ donor registration option. So this year also, you can, on your tax return, opt into the organ donor registration through the Wisconsin Donor Registry. So that's pretty exciting as well.
And you said there were a couple other changes, organ donor, and what's another new thing on the agenda?
Well, the big thing that I'm super excited about, and that's the direct file. Mm-hmm. So just a little bit of background. This year, we are partnering with the IRS on the direct file program. And what this is a safe and secure and free way to file your tax return directly with the IRS and with the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. This is open to this year some filers that are basically wage earners with minimal interest income. So the majority of our filers, we have about 830,000 taxpayers in Wisconsin that are going to be eligible for direct file. Super simple, it's secure, and it's really easy to do. Give you a little background. The way you do it, you can go out to directfile.irs.gov, and you can check to see if you are eligible to file. They take you through a series of questions asking you, you know, what your income is and if you have any special considerations that might be outside of the scope of direct file. Most people will go through it nice and easily. Once you get through the eligibility, you can sign up for their website, which is you go through ID.me and you authenticate yourself. So that's the security part, authenticates your identification. Once in there, you can file your federal tax return. It's amazing. It pulls in your W-2 data, your demographic data, calculates all of your credits that you take, and you basically hit a button. It's similar to using some of the third-party software that's on the market right now. So you file that. Once you're done filing the IRS 1040, takes about 20 minutes. When you hit submit, it takes you over to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue's site. And we call it WizTax. And at WizTax, we pull in all of that federal data. So it pre-populates your return. It has your adjusted gross income, any of the credits that you took, your W-2 information, all nice and simple. It's all there. And then we prompt you with a series of questions. We ask you what credits you would like to take. And then when you are done with that, you hit submit and your return is filed. That process takes less than 10 minutes on the Wisconsin side. So end to end, 30 minutes to file your tax return directly with the tax agencies, and it's free and secure.
And just to clarify, people reading the news may have seen on Monday Elon Musk in his position with the Trump administration responded to a sort of conspiracy theory post about direct file, saying that the agency, the computer team that had done that filing system was, quote, deleted. No explanation beyond that. Some people came away thinking, oh, wait, does that mean direct file isn't happening? Let's be really clear. Direct file, at least this year, is happening, right?
It is definitely happening, and we have a commitment from the federal treasurer that it will stay open for this year. I also want to address there were some concerns about the security of the data, mm-hmm. because that same individual has been getting into the Treasury financial system. I'm going to tell you, the Wisconsin Department of Revenue and the IRS systems are extremely secure. We have go beyond, above and beyond what most private organizations do to secure your data and make sure that it stays private and safe. And that's both with the IRS and the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
Talking to David Casey, Secretary Designee of the State Department of Revenue, as we turn tax season up to a higher notch. Now, Secretary Casey, if people had gone to the IRS site in years past, they couldn't file directly with the IRS, but there were options, many mm-hmm. of them free, some with a charge to go to third-party preparers. Are those options still out there, maybe especially for people who wouldn't be eligible for that direct file?
Absolutely. What direct file is it's an additional option, but you still can go to your accountant, your local accountant. You can use a third-party software program. Some of those do offer the free file program as well. And we still have our VITA sites, which are for their volunteer sites to assist people with preparing their tax returns. So those are all out there. What is nice about the direct file is that it is one, again, it's for about 830,000 Wisconsinites are eligible, but it's nice and simple and free. And, you know, we can't get anything better than that. Some of the others take a lot more effort, but direct file is nice and easy. I also want to point out one thing with direct file that I think is particularly beneficial to Wisconsin taxpayers. And that is that we make sure that the credits you are eligible for are offered to you. So when you go to the Wisconsin Direct File site and we have that information, if you are eligible for a child care and dependent care tax credit, or if you're eligible for the earned income tax credit, we push those out to you. We have found that often taxpayers fail to take those credits. They don't know they're eligible. But with Direct File, we're making sure that people who are eligible for the credits see them and can take them. So we hope this will help taxpayers as well.
Now, unfortunately, anytime money is changing hands, scams come along. The IRS keeps a list of a dirty dozen of common forms of tax scams. What kind of things do you have your eye on at the state level to help taxpayers avoid falling prey to any scams out there?
I mean, most of the scams that we see are identity fraud scams. So, I mean, just some basic advice that we give. Anytime that you're asked for your ID, any kind of bank account information or identification via a text or an email, don't click, don't respond to it. We have a saying here at the Department of Revenue, hover to discover, hover over those sites to see where they lead you to. It's better to directly contact your financial institutions rather than clicking on an email or a text message. That's just the safe way that we take here.
And I know at least last year there were scams targeting seniors, as I understand it, where you get a phone call from someone who says they are an IRS agent and you got to clear things up real quick by sending money. That's not going to happen from a real IRS agent, right?
Never, never. We have heard that one. It's targeting elderly or retired individuals and asking them to essentially move funds out of their retirement accounts. And once they do that, the fraudsters track that action and then can grab the money. So the IRS, the Department of Revenue, we will not ask you to do that ever.
Wanted to ask about workflow. Are things in high gear at the Department of Revenue right now for tax season, or are we slackers in Wisconsin and you really get busy come April?
Well, we're this is the exciting part of the year for us. So we're off and running. We already have 350,000 tax returns in the door in the last week. We expect to get 3.1 million over the course of the next 2 months. So 350 is a good start. And you will see the slackers. We see a few hundred thousand coming in the last day or two. But for the most part, the Wisconsinites are responsible and get their taxes done ahead of time. And they want their refunds.
If people run into a hiccup or they're uncertain about something, are there resources out there where they can reach out and get a question answered?
Absolutely. I mean, the first place to go is our website. We have tons of information out there. It's revenue.wi.gov. And once there, you can click on the individual link, and that'll take you to all the information about filing your individual tax return. There you also find ways to reach our call center. You can do that either through a phone number, or we also have a chat function as well. So we offer those basically to answer all of your questions. Hopefully with some of the resources we have, and I know with Direct File, it's super user-friendly, and you may not need to call us to get more information.
Now, you returned to the State Department of Revenue appointed by Governor Evers last year. What are some of your priorities in just our last minute while leading the Department of Revenue?
Well, customer service is always a priority. I like to say if you've got to talk to the tax department, you better make it simple and easy and clear, because a lot of people, when they call the Department of Revenue, they're just anxious and nervous about some issue that they have. So any way that we can make it simpler, that's a priority. And Direct File is one way we do that. We also have, for our business taxpayers, we have what we call My Tax Account. So all of our businesses can file directly online as well. So again, any way we can make it better for Wisconsinites and make that interaction easier, one stop, and simpler, that's our number one priority.
Secretary Casey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's David Casey, Secretary Designee of Wisconsin's Department of Revenue. We've been talking about the tax season underway and what filers should be aware of. If you've already filed, if you've tried that new option in Wisconsin, that Direct File, love to hear about your experiences with it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Do not, please, include any account information or other identity theft material. We don't want it.
On Wisconsin Today, a growing body of research highlights the strong connections between our brain and our digestive system.
The signals from the brain are basically controlling intestinal motility. They're controlling your immune responses in the gut.
Wisconsin researchers share medical advancements in the brain-gut connection. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A growing body of research highlights the strong connections between our brain and our digestive system.
The crosstalk occurring between the gut microbiome and the brain has important implications for everything from treating addiction to managing autoimmune diseases.
Researchers are discovering gut microbes have a role in our behavior, in our personality traits, and in the development of some mental illnesses.
To learn about the research, we turn to Vanessa Spirandio, a professor and chair of the Medical Microbiology and Immunology Department at UW-Madison. Vanessa, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
Let's look more closely at the gut-brain connection before we unpack your research. What can you tell us about this highway, if you will, between the brain and our gastrointestinal system?
So your brain is connected to the enteric nervous system through the vagal nerve, and the enteric nervous system has a lot of nerves in there and makes a lot of neurotransmitters that are put together into the gut where bacteria live. And you have this very dense microbiota in there, very rich in different species of bacteria that also produce several metabolites and signals that in turn are sensed through the enteric nervous system and can go all the way to the brain and alter behaviors, impact neurodegenerative diseases, and also addiction behaviors, amongst other things.
So what I'm hearing is that the gut and the brain have this crosstalk going. Can the gut act independently without the brain saying, hey, do this? Or are these signals from the brain giving orders to the gut? What is the hierarchy like?
So they are interconnected because the signals from the brain are basically controlling intestinal motility. They're controlling your immune responses in the gut. And they are also controlling chloride and potassium secretion and homeostasis in general. And on the other side, the bacterial signals can travel to the brain and also impact different behaviors. And we're starting to understand, because this is a nascent field in biology.
Starting to understand, why is it so important to understand the gut-brain connection here and this gut-brain access? What might it unlock?
So there are several things that it can unlock. For example, we now understand that bacteria, including bacterial pathogens, can actually sense neurotransmitters, things like adrenaline, serotonin, endocannabinoids, and they can either enhance or decrease the virulence of this bacterial enteric pathogens. So we can actually adapt some agonists and antagonists of these neurotransmitters, for example, that are already used in the clinic for other things, to try to use as therapeutics against enteric infections. One such example would be serotonin. Serotonin decreases bacterial virulence. The other example would be that several members of your microbiota, they can actually impact your behaviors. For example, if you have an expansion of E. coli. E. coli is part of your commensal microbiota, but usually it's a very small amount of E. coli that you have. If that population expands, okay, it starts to use an amino acid that you have called glycine in the intestine. And glycine actually prevents people from becoming addicted to cocaine. And if you have an expansion of E. coli, the levels of glycine go down and you enhance, for example, cocaine addiction behaviors, cocaine seeking behaviors, cocaine administration behaviors. You make things worse. And you can think about ways now in which you can correct that, because you can actually correct that by giving glycine back, or even sarcosine. Sarcosine is a precursor for glycine, and it's a food supplement. You can just go to GNC. It's used by many athletes.
It's so interesting how you can apply this to substance use disorders, which so many Americans are struggling with. But when you think of these substances, whether it's an opioid or something else, they can kind of hijack the brain's reward center, you know, triggering those feelings of pleasure. How could that be counteracted with gut microbes?
Yes. In the case of psychoactive drugs, they act through this pathway that's activated by glycine in the gut, in the brain. And when you use cocaine, you increase the levels of adrenaline in the brain and also in the gut. And this adrenaline drives the expansion of E. coli. And E. coli starts using a lot of glycine, and then it becomes kind of a feedback mechanism in which you become more addicted. You have pharmacological interventions for alcoholism and also opioid addiction, but you have none for psychoactive drugs such as methamphetamine and cocaine. So this could be one way in which, you know, it's one mechanism, and we can actually hopefully find other mechanisms too.
This also could have applications for infectious diseases. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So in the case of infectious diseases, for example, if you increase the levels of serotonin in the gut, you have a protective effect against infections such as E. coli, Salmonella, which are some of the most prevalent gastrointestinal pathogens. And for example, you can do that by giving a lot of serotonin, or you can do that by using Prozac. If you inhibit the reuptake of serotonin and increase accumulation in the intestine, which is what one of the things that Prozac does, it becomes protective against enteric infections. So you could have like a double use of something that's already FDA approved.
So as we continue to learn more about the gut microbiome and addiction, how do you see this changing the pharmaceutical industry and changing treatment?
So first of all, it could facilitate the development of antimicrobials at large. Usually, the pharmaceutical industry is a little recalcitrant on developing novel antibiotics because most of the times, by the time they're finishing developing the antibiotic, resistance already occurred, and that becomes something complicated and super expensive. But targeting systems like this one, for example, the serotonin-based system, you're not killing any of these pathogens, you're just disarming them. And then your immune system takes care of it. So it's a little more gentle. It's kind of like not going with a hammer, but going with a scalp.
Mm, yeah, that makes sense. This is such an exciting research area. Things are changing here. And I'm just wondering, you know, your research into the gut microbiome, it is funded in part by the NIH, and medical researchers at the NIH are really concerned about funding and whether their research might be impacted. Do you have concerns at this point?
I think everybody at this point has concerns because we are completely dependent on NIH. The vast majority of us, like over 95% of investigators in this area, they are completely dependent on NIH. So if the funding disappears, the possibility of developing new treatments will also go with it.
And so you are just kind of watching day to day as to what unfolds?
Yes, because what I think the general public needs to understand is that it's not just paying for the research, but it's paying for the researchers, the people who are actually spending, you know, 60 hours a week working, trying to discover how nature works and how these relationships that we have with microbes and disease work, so we can actually develop and translate this information into something that's going to help the health and improve the life of the general population.
Vanessa, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Vanessa Spirindio is a professor and chair of the Medical Microbiology and Immunology Department at UW-Madison. She talked with us about her research on substance abuse disorder and the gut microbiome. Next, we'll look at another scientist's work on gut bacteria, specifically how the ketogenic diet can affect gut health. Maggie Alexander is an assistant professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Madison. Maggie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Given what a huge influence gut bacteria has on our nervous systems, I mean, it really follows into what we eat, into what we're thinking about behavior. Can you tell us about your research and your discoveries and what you're looking into?
Absolutely. Yeah. So our research is really focused on trying to understand the mechanisms of the interactions between what we eat in our diets, our gut microbiota, and the immune responses. And we're right now particularly interested in this in the context of autoimmune diseases. One of the ways that we think about this is, you know, trying to understand microbes that are associated with disease states, so associated with autoimmunity. So let's say we have a microbe that's increased in abundance in an autoimmune state like inflammatory bowel disease. Our question is, can we understand how that microbe is impacting immune responses? And then use our understanding of how that is working to sort of come in with more targeted interventions. And in particular, thinking about, can we use diet to sort of manipulate this interaction between a disease-associated microbe and the immune response that's kind of driving disease?
That's so interesting because, you know, we are so much in control of what we eat and diet and how that could actually influence these diseases, that has huge repercussions.
Yeah, I think of it as, you know, it's sort of a more attainable thing to try and do. And, you know, we're trying to understand how these interactions work so we can more understand, you know, how those sort of interactions might be able to be leveraged more in order to get sort of the responses that you're wanting to see in your, you know, autoimmune conditions. Yeah. And then we have sort of another way of thinking about this is sort of more from, you know, the diet perspective of, you know, people that are trying to shape your diet to impact positively a disease state that you have. And so there's really interesting sort of clinical trial data and as well as sort of these dietary recommendations. But one of the problems, I think, is that we don't really understand fully the mechanisms of how our diets are impacting our microbiota and the immune response associated with that. And so one of our goals is to try and understand more about how diet is actually impacting the microbiota and impacting how the microbes are talking to the immune system.
Have you looked at particular diets that affect the gut and potentially these diseases?
Yeah, so we're looking at a really fascinating case study right now, which is a ketogenic diet and multiple sclerosis. And so in the literature, there's been some really interesting previous work that's seen a protective effect of a ketogenic diet in clinical trials in a particular autoimmune condition, which is multiple sclerosis. And so one of our goals is try and understand how this is happening, because it wasn't really clear fully how a ketogenic diet could have a general protective effect in this autoimmune condition of multiple sclerosis. And so that's one of the things that we're working on right now, is trying to understand, you know, what is happening on the host side in response to this diet, as well as microbiota dependent mechanisms of this. And so, for example, what we've seen so far is that during a ketogenic diet, you have this sort of switch in host metabolism into making ketone bodies like beta hydroxybutyrate. And we've seen that this production of beta hydroxybutyrate is actually able to sort of recapitulate these protective effects of the full ketogenic diet in our mouse models of multiple sclerosis. So that's really exciting to see. Just, you know, one of the things that changes during this diet can mediate that effect. And so that's helping us get more into really the mechanisms of how this diet can change the host metabolism to think about, you know, more specific ways that this is impacting disease states. And then we can think about how that's impacting the microbiota side, because what's really interesting from the microbiota perspective is that there's been this really strong connection of microbiota and autoimmune conditions, where if you transplant a microbiota that's shaped by an autoimmune condition like multiple sclerosis into mouse models of disease, that leads to worse disease severity in these mouse models. And so there's really this strong sort of connection between that disrupted microbial composition and leading to differences in these disease outcomes. And so that's what we've been looking into in terms of the ketogenic diet and protective effect in multiple sclerosis, what microbiota mechanisms are involved in this as well.
Can you describe just a bit what a keto diet is like? And are there particular foods that might be triggering these things?
Yeah, so a ketogenic diet is a really fascinating diet. It was originally developed to sort of mimic a fasting state. And so basically what it's doing is severely restricting the carbohydrate intake and usually increasing the amount of fat. And the idea behind this is to sort of switch the host metabolism from breaking down carbohydrates as an energy source into switching to breaking down free fatty acids. And so there's many ways to sort of do this, but in general, the ways to do this is you know, trying to restrict carbohydrate-heavy foods and usually increasing the intake of more fatty foods. But you can see how that, you know, increasing a lot of fat intake might have negative impacts on certain conditions, especially like heart conditions. And so this is part of our motivation in trying to understand more about, okay, what is actually beneficial about this change, and can we sort of get away from the other impacts that might actually have detrimental effects on people's health?
There is also some emerging research that finds that the keto diet may help with severe mental illness, including schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. What is it about ketosis that seems to have such a strong effect on the brain?
Yeah, so I think there's been really exciting research on this area too, and including mental illness and as well as Alzheimer's here at UW-Madison. People are working on this, thinking about how this change in ketogenesis might impact these brain states. And this is, you know, these ketone bodies are thought to be a fuel for the brain, but I think we're still really trying to understand exactly how these changes are mediating the effects that are seen in these sort of pilot clinical trials.
There are so many variables at play as you lay this out. And so as our understanding of the gut microbiome continues to evolve and scientists make more of these connections, do you see this playing a role in how we end up treating disease in the future and what is prescribed?
Absolutely. I think this is something that, you know, I think people are starting to consider, both thinking about in terms of designing clinical trials, considering the background microbiota composition, even the background diet composition of people that are participating in these clinical trials. This is starting to become more and more appreciated that because these things have effects on disease states, that it's really important to consider these factors when thinking about the efficacy of new pharmaceuticals that are coming out or new interventions that are becoming appreciated. And so I think as we gain more and more information, we're going to be able to more readily understand thinking about, you know, when we need to consider sort of the microbiota and diet and looking at these particular responses. And one of the things I'm really interested in is, you know, can we use, you know, some of these things like a microbiota composition to be able to predict maybe a response to a dietary intervention or a response to a pharmacological intervention. And so I think this is sort of a really exciting time to be thinking about these things.
Maggie, thank you for sharing your research.
Thank you so much.
Maggie Alexander is an assistant professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Madison. And earlier, we spoke with Professor Vanessa Spirandio, who chairs this department. We've been learning about the latest research into the gut-brain connection.
Still ahead, Wisconsin plays host to a North American biathlon tournament. Check out the event and what goes into the sport that combines skiing and shooting.
Your heart is pounding and you're trying to calm down, but you still have to shoot really fast and you have to shoot really accurate, so you're balancing brain and brawn.
That's next here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about one of Wisconsin's and the nation's most treasured birds.
People flock to Prairie du Sac in mid-January for the annual Bald Eagle Watching Days. As Christina Leffering tells us, it was an opportunity for people to see our national bird in the wild, one that was dangerously close to extinction.
The frosty winds off the bluffs of the Wisconsin River feel extra biting on this chilly morning in Prairie du Sac. At the Overlook, a small crowd with binoculars and telephoto camera lenses are braving the cold for Bald Eagle Watching Days. Mike and Connie Amig traveled from Marshfield so Connie could see the birds for her birthday.
I absolutely love bald eagles. I just think they are so majestic. And I wanted to see them in the wild. And when I was growing up, it was very rare to see one. And it's wonderful that there's more and more that you get to see in the wild.
Even people who grew up in areas where eagles nest have noticed them in more areas. Robin Miner of Baraboo says she used to see bald eagles fairly often when she was a student at UW La Crosse decades ago.
That was back when it was more rare to see them. So it's nice to be closer to home and be able to see such a beautiful, magnificent bird.
Their experiences align with what avian biologists have documented for the past 50 years. The bald eagle population in the United States was driven almost to extinction. Due to the work of conservationists and a 1972 DDT ban, the bald eagle population has made an amazing recovery in Wisconsin.
50 years ago, back in 1975, we had 111 pairs. Today, we have nearly 1,700 nesting pairs.
That's Sumner Madison, avian ecologist with the DNR, who was at the Prairie du Sac Overlook for Bald Eagle Watching Days.
It's been probably one of the most satisfying things for me in my career is to come out and interact with the public and to see their appreciation for these birds.
In 2025, DNR officials said they located bald eagle breeding pairs in every county in Wisconsin. While the bald eagle recovery is considered a success story, their population has not fully recovered. Darlene Williams of Janesville had never seen a bald eagle in the wild before today's event.
Well, as that one just went by, it's just like it's magnificent. It just makes you feel good. This is one of my bucket lists, one of my goals, and I'm happy to be able to be here today.
Williams' friend Miner chimes in.
I'm sure there were people who had never seen one, like Darlene, and to see one is, I think it still brings you that kind of joy and excitement and that you're seeing something special.
Miner says she's seen groups like Raptor Education Group, Inc., or REGGIE, release eagles that have recovered from injury back into the wild.
That was magnificent because I'm sure there's people who think, why are you spending time and money to rehabilitate a wild animal? But I think they're a special species, and I'm sure there's other species out there, too, that need the same attention. But this one has proven to work.
And there's still more work to do. Marge Gibson is the founder of REGGIE. She says there are three main reasons bald eagles are brought to a rehabilitation center. Either they are hit by cars, lead poisoned by lead shot or fishing lures, or poisoned with herbicides, pesticides, and rodent poison in their food.
There are a lot of things we can do better. The public can make changes to make the environment safer.
As attendee Maggie Spott points out, other species, like Canadian geese and sandhill cranes, were once also on the edge of extinction and are now so ubiquitous that some consider them pests.
That's how it should be. We should be seeing a large number of these animals. It shouldn't get to the point where we have to worry about them going extinct. We have to continue to protect them to prevent something like that from ever happening again.
Bald eagles can be seen in other parts of the contiguous U.S., but it's rare. To see several breeding pairs flying, fishing, and nesting in the wild, for now, that's a sight special to Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's very cool.
It's larger than I thought.
Christina Leffring brought us that story on Bald Eagle Watching Days. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. Brilliant in eastern Wisconsin will host the first ever U.S. and North American Biathlon Masters Championships this month.
Aaron's Nordic Center will be the site of the competition that combines cross-country skiing with rifle target shooting.
It's a partnership between U.S. Biathlon and Biathlon Canada to bring the continent's top athletes to the small Wisconsin community east of Appleton.
We're learning more about the growth of the sport and why this international competition is coming to Brilliant. Greg Pattison is a U.S. Biathlon Masters athlete and coach from Neenah, and Sean Becker is director of sport operations of the Aaron's Nordic Center. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Greg, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Can you paint us a picture, Greg, of the sport of biathlon for people who aren't familiar with the sport?
Well, it's a mix of Nordic skiing, which is highly aerobic, and then you ski around with a 22 rifle, and you come into the range and you try to hit targets. And if you don't hit targets, you have to ski some extra distance. And it makes your race longer and makes you grumpy. And you combine a whole bunch of those skiing and shooting to form a race that's about, I don't know, 45 minutes long.
And Greg, when I've watched this, sometimes you're shooting from a standing position and sometimes from a prone position, right? There could be some variation in how that shot works.
Yeah, the prone is a laying down, and it's very much a precise marksman shooting. We're standing, the barrel wiggles a little bit more, and it's more reflex shooting.
Now, Sean, at Aaron's Nordic Center, you do a lot of different kind of sports and events. Biathlon, how popular is it? Is it growing in interest?
Definitely at our venue, it's growing in interest. Each time that we have a race, usually once a month at our venue, either throughout the summer or the winter, we notice that our novice division grows each time that we have a competition. And that can grow anywhere from having four or five to 15 or 20. And we like to see that sort of interest, you know, sparked in the sport, especially here in the Midwest, because there aren't a lot of places to do this around here.
Sean, what goes into making a biathlon course, a space, kind of space demanding, I guess, for this event? What did you have to do to make this happen?
Well, you know, from a venue perspective, during the winter, obviously, with low snow that we've had the last couple of years, we have to build our course every single, you know, start of every single winter. So here we have about a 7.5 meter wide course that is probably about right now about 3.5 kilometers in length. And we've got average of about 2 to 3.5 feet deep snow throughout that entire course so that we can weather through some of these warm spells that we get. And so in order to do that, you know, we're manufacturing our own snow round the clock for as many days as we can get it in. We spent about a month making snow this year. We need that to guarantee competitions like what we have coming up.
Greg, I want to talk a little more about the challenge of the sport. It's one thing to target shoot standing still at a range. Well, now, hold on. You're doing, you know, an intense aerobic exercise, skiing, presumably as fast as you can because you want to win the race. Well, then your heart rate's up. Maybe your hands are shaking. You're breathing harder. How much more challenging is it to hit that target given that you're skiing? You've just been skiing and you know you're hopping right back up.
Yeah, it's like having buck fever and doing it every lap. I mean, your heart is pounding and you're trying to calm down, but you still have to shoot really fast and you have to shoot really accurate. So you're balancing brain and brawn. You know, it's kind of like NASCAR and then stopping in to hit some precise golf shots and then going back out on the NASCAR lane again. It's very challenging and it takes a lot of training for the high-end athletes. The more simpler people just come in and do it and see it and experience it and say, oh my, that was hard.
Greg, what got you into the sport in the first place?
Oh, I love adventures. I was a racer. I like brain brawn sports. I love shooting. I love skiing. I brought the two together. I travel and compete nationally, and I really enjoy it. And now we're branching into, I love coaching the next generation and getting them to represent the USA. You know, we're a national training center. And I enjoy giving back and have a passion and ability to do it.
And Sean, how important is that element to you, the idea of training a next generation of people who do it for fun, but maybe that next generation of international competitors?
That is a huge part of what we do here. And Greg is a major part of that. Being that he's the biathlon guru, has pretty much taught me everything that I know about biathlon up to this point. Being able to bring athletes from other areas around the Midwest for high performance camps where we can spend time getting them prepped and ready for that that next step is really a satisfying thing to see when these athletes move to that next level. Just the other day, Greg forwarded me a picture of one of the athletes that we've had here training the last couple of years that has made it to the IBU Cup level in Europe, and he finally got to put on the U.S. ski team, U.S. biathlon team suit for the very first time. Mm. And to me, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's you know, where you're cashing the checks. These kids are going to move on and be the next crop of biathletes representing the U.S. And just to say that we had a small part to do with them to support them in their endeavors is really what we're built for, what we're designed for here.
We're talking about a biathlon in Wisconsin in the upcoming U.S. Biathlon Masters Nationals and North American Masters Championships at Aaron's Nordic Center in Brilliant. We've got Nordic Center Director of Sport Operations Sean Becker, Biathlon Masters athlete and coach Greg Pattison. Sean, let's stay with you. This Masters Championship coming up at Aaron's Nordic Center. Tell us about the event and the significance of it coming here to Wisconsin.
Yeah, this is a fantastic opportunity for us here at Aaron's. You know, the U.S. Biathlon came to us and said, you know, we're looking to hold a Masters National, a NORAMS event, so North American Championships. And then the Canadian team, that's athletes that are coming here as well, are also having their championships here. So we've got three huge races all happening basically in one biathlon festival weekend. To be able to host not only the master level athletes, 30 and up, essentially, from the U.S. get to come and see what we're all about, but also to be able to have our first real international competition happen here, I think is really going to help put us on the map for these type of events going forward.
And Greg, as an athlete and a coach yourself, what does it mean for you? How big a deal is it for Brilliant to become really the center of this sport in North America for that weekend?
Well, it is really good. I mean, we have the Western athletes from the mountains coming to the Midwest, and we have the Eastern with the wetter snow coming over, and we'll all be skiing here from the north of the border as well. You know, there's 100 athletes probably that will be showing up here to this race, and it'll be one big festival, and we're going to enjoy our niche sport together in racing and competing.
What is, Greg, the level of competition like at an event? Well, this is the first event, but what kind of competition do you expect here, given that we're bringing athletes from all over the country and Canada?
Well, it's going to be a mix. I mean, I'd say there's a top few percent that are really going for it. They're going to be the champions, and they've been training hard, and this is a fruition of their efforts. But the majority will not be like that. They will be, I want to come, I want to have fun. I want to ski, I want to shoot with my rifle on a wonderful world-class situation. And they come just because they're green side up, and they enjoy this sport, and they're going to have a good time. And it's a mix.
Now, Sean, did I see this right? There are age categories, and there is a 70-plus age category?
That's correct. I think we already have two people signed up in that 70-plus age category. You know, I always say that I want to still be cross-country skiing when I'm 80-plus. I still want to be doing Birkebeiners as long as I possibly can. And there are still athletes out there that will come. It might take them a long time to get around our course. They're going to probably shoot pretty darn accurately, but it's going to really be cool to see those athletes come that are in that 70-plus age division.
And Greg, if someone's listening thinking, this sounds cool, this looks cool, I've never done it before, some advice for someone who wants to give it a try, even if they don't know if they're willing to commit to it hard at the beginning?
Well, there are a few clubs across Wisconsin, and they all have a way where you can go and try. We have one almost every Wednesday, every other, where you can sign up on the Aaron's Nordic Center website, and you can take a shot at biathlon. $20, 20 bullets, you're going to spend all that money and have lots of laughs. And it's a way to try it. We have lots of people who come just to have fun. They don't have any intent of doing the athletic part of it. They just want to do the shooting part and try out the $5,000 really cool rifles.
And we'll leave it there. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And Sean, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. This was great.
Sean Becker is the Director of Sport Operations of the Aaron's Nordic Center in Brilliant, and Greg Pattison is a U.S. Biathlon Masters athlete and coach from NINA. They're with us for a preview of the first ever U.S. Biathlon Masters Nationals and North American Masters Championships happening at Aaron's Nordic Center on February 14th and 15th.
We talked about the foster care system in Wisconsin yesterday, and we heard the heartfelt story of a Milwaukee foster family.
We also learned about a summer camp that's now called Belong Wisconsin.
Its executive director wrote in to say that they will be holding siblings camp this summer and that they continue to expand the work that started with the camp's original name, Camp to Belong Wisconsin.
Are you involved or have you been involved in a Belong Wisconsin program that unites children in foster care with their biological siblings? What is it meant to you? Or maybe it's another type of camp that creates a positive impact in the lives of children. Tell us about it. Share your story about a camp that's made a special impact on you or your family.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.